The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
So first thing they do is in 2017, when Daisy Kendrick is just out of college, they give her what is originally announced as a $5 million grant. In the end, she gets $3 million to a charity, a nonprofit that she had started like a year earlier, a really small, you know, charity. It listed, to give you a sense of how small it was, when she incorporated it, she listed three directors, including herself. The other two directors told us later that they had never heard of it, didn't know they were part of it, barely knew Daisy Kendrick. That's how small this organization was. So the UN gives this group $3 million to raise awareness about the oceans, to produce a pop song, to produce a video game. So that was the strangeness. People at the UN were like, out of all the groups in the world that raise awareness, that, you know, have networks, that know how to get awareness about the oceans, you gave $3 million to a college grad, you know, just 23-year-old to do this? Why? And then after that, then they started giving loans to her father, eventually totaling $58 million, some to build renewable energy projects, and some to build houses. The plan was to build like 1.1 million houses across the development.
I'm Jacob Schultz, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, May 13th, 2022. David Farenthold is a reporter who works for the New York Times. In his capacity as a reporter at the Washington Post, he reported on misdeeds within the Trump financial universe. And now, he just came out with a story in the Times about a peculiar financial scandal at the United Nations. It's about a little-known UN agency trusting tens of millions of dollars to relatively unknown British businessmen and the investment not quite working out. I talked with David about his story and about the broader world at the United Nations that enables this to happen. It's the Lawfare Podcast, May 13th, a scandal at the UN.
Hey everyone, Lawfare Senior Editor Scott R. Anderson here with a quick interjection. Shortly after running this episode, we received a letter from lawyers representing David and Daisy Kendrick disputing some of the representations in the discussion that follows. To address their concerns, we've posted excerpts from that letter stating the positions of Mr. and Ms. Kendrick on this episode's show page on the Lawfare website. You can find a link in the show notes for this episode. Now, back to Jacob.
We are going to dive into all the specifics as we go on, but just using sort of vague titles, not actually using names, and at a very high altitude, maybe like 10,000 foot view, give us a quick overview of what happened in the story, and then we'll sort of pick apart the specifics.
What you had here was an agency at the UN that ended up with millions of dollars more than they needed or that they knew what to do with. And they decided they were looking around for something to do with this money. They wanted to invest it, which they had never done before. They met a guy at a party, and they decided to give $61 million to him or to his family. So they loaned him $58 million to invest around the world. They gave his daughter a $3 million grant for her charity. And now everyone regrets that. At least $22 million that they loaned him has been declared bad debt, defaulted, and the number could go up. The investments seem to have ended in tragedy, and the UN has fired or asked for the resignation of the person who oversaw it all.
So I think maybe the best place to start is with the office itself. So what on earth is the UN Office for Project Services?
Basically, it was designed to be the UN's general contractor. So, a lot of agencies at the UN have money and want to do things, you know, good things in the world. The idea was, why don't we have one agency at the UN that knows how to do logistical tasks, build a road, build a house, you know, defuse landmines. They're the people who know the guy who builds the house in Yemen. They know the guy who builds roads in Ghana. And so that any other UN agency that wanted to do logistical tasks would hire these people and they would get it done. Now, that's like a really important job, and they, by all accounts, do it well. But what we ran across was that in the UN system, the sort of prestige in the UN, they don't have a lot of prestige, because prestige comes from giving out grants, from giving out money, standing at podiums, giving orders, and these guys take orders. You know, they're the ones who do, not the ones who talk. And talking at the UN is the key. And so it seemed like they wanted to be more visible. They didn't want this kind of behind the scenes role, as good at it as they were.
And so historically, like when they're functioning in their best capacity, like maybe give an example of like what's something that they could do, or what's like a big success that they've had.
So some of their biggest successes include delivering medicine, delivering, hospital supplies, medical supplies to places around the world, building roads all over Africa, building roads, you know, in developing countries all over the world, building schools. You can look at their website. There's dozens and dozens of projects all around the world where they're building things. I mean, they seem to be good at that, but the problem was that wasn't good enough for them.
And you mentioned a bit in your first answer there that there's all these sort of different funding streams at the UN, right? And different UN agencies have money, and they want to do something with it. Talk just in sort of general terms for people who aren't as familiar of like how the money side of the UN works, because I think that's important here. Like, where is this money coming from? How does it end up at different agencies? Like, what level of discretion do different agencies have over where it goes? Stuff like that.
I am new to the UN, so I understand this at the 10,000 foot level. I'll give you that. If I go any lower, I will get it wrong. Basically, UN member states pay dues to the UN, and they also, if you're, you know, the US or China or a particularly wealthy member state, you can add extra money into specific agencies to do the things that you want. So everybody's heard of like UNICEF, that's a UN agency, UN Development Program, they help people, you know, they do development projects around the world. So the money goes from countries, taxpayers in various countries, to those UN agencies like the Development Program or UNICEF. And then it would go, they would then basically contract with this other agency, UN Office for Project Services. They'd hire them like a contractor and then pay them the cost of the contract, the cost to build the road or build the school or whatever. And then the Office for Project Services would add a fee on top, a management fee, was like 5%. And that's why they ended up with so much extra money, is because they were charging their brother or sister agencies a bigger management fee than they really needed.
And so, and historically, to the people who are on the other side of that contract, the people who the Office of Project Services contact, they're just people who are maybe networked to the UN, right? They're like for-profit companies, right, on the other side of this?
Yeah, there would be, you know, somebody, a company that builds roads in one of these countries. And so the UN Office of Project Services would have that relationship, make sure that was a good, reliable contractor. And so then the UN, every time a UN agency wanted to build roads in Ghana, they wouldn't have to go through like reinventing the wheel of finding the best company to do that.
Right. So I think your story, part of what's made it get so much traction, is it's very like personality driven story.
Yeah.
There's like big characters in here. So I think maybe the best place to start from the personality side is in that office. So in the UN Office on Project Services. So introduce us to the people who are the main players in the story, just within that office first.
The head of the agency was a woman named Greta Faramo. She had been a politician in Norway. She was the defense minister of Norway, the justice minister of Norway, sort of a big deal in Norwegian politics. And she'd come to this UN agency and seeming determined to sort of make a name for herself there. She wrote a whole essay in Harvard Business Review about how there, you know, she had basically, you know, been opposed by naysayers and anti-capitalists in her agency, but she's, you know, she pushed past that and, you know, powered through. And, you know, she said, like, I threw 1200 pages of rules in the trash because I felt like they were too rule bound. So that's her ambition, is to be seen as like a, you know, someone who's running the UN like a business, an innovative manager inside the UN. Her number two is a guy named Vitaly Vanchelbon, who's a Ukrainian. He'd been in the UN forever, and also a healthy sense of confidence for him. He was not much of a public-facing person, but was sort of regarded in the UN as like a exacting financial genius. And one person told us that, you know, other employees take beta blockers, the blood pressure medication, just to talk to him. I mean, to me, the thing that sums up him best is his own words. His LinkedIn profile and his Twitter bio are both written in all caps, and that begins serial overachiever. So that's the sort of sense of confidence he has in his management ability. So these are two people who run kind of a grubby, important, but low profile agency, but they are not low profile people. Their ambition is not just to do this grubby job well. They want something more.
Yeah. And so how did they translate that into changing the way the agency operated?
Well, I was really surprised. I guess I'm used to dealing with the U.S. government where there's a lot of, you know, the head of an agency doesn't have a huge amount of control over how money is spent. You know, it's legislated by Congress. There's rules and regulations. The U.N. is much less rule bound than you would think. So this was their agency and they had been charging other agencies more money than they needed. And they got to like $100 million of extra money, like just surplus. And they didn't know what to do with it. And so these two officials basically decided And their auditors and other people in the UN are like, just, you know, charge less fees, give the money back. Like, this is not your money. Why do you don't need $100 million extra dollars. You deserve, you're a contractor. But they want what other people in the UN have, which is their own pot of money, their own ability to give out grants and sort of stand, you know, cut a ribbon, sign a contract. So they decide that they're going to start loaning it out like a bank. That's their plan. Is they're going to start loaning out this operational reserve for, because they have $100 million and they really think they only need 20 or 30 as really like as a real surplus, as a check against, you know, bad debts or rainy days. So they're going to start loaning out the rest like a bank. And that's something the UN has never done. And so that would, in theory, that would take them from the back rank, the less prestigious part of the UN, to the front. Now they're the first investment bank working with the private sector. And they say that, like, you know, Greta Ferramo, the head of it in her essay at Harvard Business Review, is like, you know, people said it in our agency said it was a bad idea. They don't like capitalists. They think capitalists are mercenaries. Like, we're going to show them all they were wrong, you know, and show them we were right.
And so what did they, right, they end up with this huge pot of money. And then there's this sort of, what do we do with this question? And how did they go about resolving that?
Well, they needed somebody to give this money to, but we're talking about people that have really no experience. They have lots of experience in government and at the UN, but they don't really have any experience in the private sector. And what they want is not something that they are purposefully targeting projects that are sort of marginal for the private sector. They're not going to spend money to build a cell phone business or to like sell Coca-Cola in India or, you know, pick something that the private sector would do because it would be obviously a moneymaker. They're there to do things that are like development projects. What they want to do is build renewable energy installations. They want to build housing in the third world.
To be clear, this is how like most of the UN operates, right? This is the goal of large parts of the UN, right?
Totally. But they're going to do it. Everybody else does it through grants. They're going to do it through loans. So you're going to, the idea is to make development into a money-making process. So they're inexperienced and they're also aiming for a tiny slice of the business community. People who think they can, who want loans from the UN and want to deal with the UN's bureaucracy and think they can make money doing things that are basically development projects, not, you know, pure money-making. So it's a hard job to begin with. And I think they spend a lot of time looking for people who will take their money and who want to get into this with them and have trouble finding it. And so then they come across this guy, David Kendrick, at a party. And he says, that's exactly what I want. I have a company that can build projects all over the developing world. You know, you're just the people for me. And I think they said, well, thank God, you know, because if you look at their auditor's reports, there's no indication that they compared this company to that company and they were looking at different offers and thinking about diversifying. Maybe we should invest with this company and a little bit with that company. When they found this guy, they were like, oh, thank God, take all of our money. And they really gave him $58 million in the span of 18 months.
So before we get back to Kendrick, you made that distinction between grants versus loans. And most of the UN is doing things via grants. Talk a bit about like how does that skew the recipient pool, right? Like who are the people, who are the organizations or the people who tend to be interested in getting grants versus like, you know, what is the profile in general, maybe stereotyped terms of someone who wants this type of loan, right? Like why does that distinction matter?
Well, it's because you're looking for people who think they can make a profit. You know, you're looking for people who don't just want to take the money and build a road or build a school or whatever. You're looking for people who think they can make a profit. And so that's a small sector of people who are trying to build houses. This is a hard job to build houses in the developing world. You know, the payback on these projects would come by people, you know, like you build houses in Ghana, people in Ghana buy them from you, which requires setting up a mortgage system. Mortgage systems in other countries are not as easy to use as they are in the US. So you're looking for somebody who thinks they can navigate that system and take your loan, build houses and make money not just in one country, in a whole, they were thinking about seven or nine countries. So You're going to master the legal system and the political connections you need in Antigua to build houses and sell them and make money, and then also do it in Ghana and do it in India, places that really have nothing in common. They were looking for somebody that probably didn't exist, a company that had that kind of ambition but didn't already have backing and had no connection to other funding sources and would want to deal with the UN. You know, one of the reasons other people didn't want to deal with the UN is you can't sue the UN. Right. So, you know, why would you want to get in a business partnership alone with somebody that you can't sue if it goes wrong? So, you know, you can see how we're starting to narrow down even further the set of people who might think this was worth their while and also who might think that they could actually make money on a project like this.
Right. So sort of desperate and hopelessly ambitious people.
Yeah, it would have to be somebody who would like had a huge amount of ambition and nobody else to back them. So, yeah, you're looking at people who are kind of by definition long shots.
And so they end up with this guy, Kendrick. Talk to us about, so who is this guy? Who, maybe talk a bit about the person who introduced them. And why is, like, what is the profile of this man?
Well, I guess I'll start with the introduction, because the introduction gives you a sense a little bit of who we're dealing with here. You know, the person who introduced them tells you about who's being introduced. So the introducer in this case was a guy named Paolo Zampoli. He is most famous as the person who introduced Donald Trump to Melania Trump back in the day, because Paolo was a modeling executive for whom Melania worked at the time. He knew Trump well. He worked for Trump for a while. This is a guy who's he's originally Italian. His fortune comes from the fact that his father introduced the Easy Bake Oven to Italy. So then he has come to the U.S. many years ago. He's a U.S. citizen now. He's been kind of a man about town. He's had a man about town jobs. He was a sort of very high-end realtor. He was a modeling executive. He hosted parties. Yeah, he's sort of a, you know, if you know the New York tabloid, sort of a Page Six staple, somebody who dated models. And, you know, he now has this weird world where he is an ambassador to the United Nations from the island of Dominica, not the Dominican Republic, the Dominica, little island in the Caribbean, that he became an ambassador, not the ambassador, but one of their ambassadors to the UN. That gets him access to this whole social world of the UN. At the same time, he's also taking side projects that are just for profit. And so at the time of the introduction was made, he was a UN ambassador. He could go to the UN parties. He's part of the UN, but he also was using his connections to introduce UN people to this guy, David Kendrick, who Kendrick is a British man, mostly lives in Spain, is a very small public profile for somebody who has supposedly been in business as long as he has. He's involved in, you know, more than a couple dozen companies that all sort of interlock. Most of them flow up through shell companies to a family office in Gibraltar, the British territory. The main thing that they seem to do, he's dabbled in the record business and a bunch of other stuff. The main thing they seem to do is construction. They have this process that supposedly allows you to build fast, sturdy, cheap houses, you know, and other structures too, and mostly aimed at the developing world. So I spent a lot of time, and I have to go to the expenses today, at least $1,000 on corporate records from places like Spain, Gibraltar, Singapore, where all his companies are, looking for, like, where's the money? You know, where's the fortune? Where's the success? And he certainly has companies that have made losses. And the UN said that the main partner company they did business with had lost like $20 million the years before. But I can't see his whole business because part of it is so opaque. So I don't know how successful he is, but he was somebody who was in the business that the UN desperately wanted to be in, building homes in the developing world. And then thanks to Paolo Zampoli, they met him at a party. The heads of this UN agency met Kendrick at a party in 2015.
And so what comes after that? So they give him this substantial amount of money and also give his daughter some money, right?
Well, yeah, it starts with his daughter. And that honestly was what drew us into this story, because this part seems so strange. So this UN agency, the Office for Project Services, had never given out any grants before in its history. Remember, it does stuff. It doesn't give money away. So the heads of this agency meet David Kendrick and his daughter, Daisy, who is, I think, like 21 at the time, a college student still, at this party in 2015. And they give this. The first thing they do is in 2017, when Daisy Kendrick is just out of college, they give her what is originally announced as a $5 million grant. In the end, she gets $3 million. To a charity, a nonprofit that she had started like a year earlier, a really small, you know, charity. It listed, to give you a sense of how small it was, when she incorporated it, she listed three directors, including herself. The other two directors told us later that they had never heard of it, didn't know they were part of it, barely knew Daisy Kendrick. That's how small this organization was. So the UN gives this group $3 million to raise awareness about the oceans, to produce a pop song, to produce a video game. So that was the strangeness. People at the UN were like, you know, out of all the groups in the world that raise awareness, that, you know, have networks that know how to get awareness about the oceans, you gave $3 million to a college grad, you know, just a 23-year-old to do this. Why? And then after that, then they started giving loans to her father, eventually totaling $58 million, some to build renewable energy projects and some to build houses. The plan was to build like 1.1 million houses across the developing world.
And did that happen?
No, not at all. Not a single house has been built anywhere, which is amazing. They gave him loans for 7 countries. Not a single house was built. Not a single renewable energy project was built. They did spend some money to buy a wind farm in Mexico, an existing wind farm. But apparently that did not go that well either, because the UN in 2020 began asking for its money back and Kendrick's company didn't give it back. And explained, apparently, according to auditors, that the wind farm, even the one sort of physical thing they had bought, was losing money.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact. You can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Could your political views make you the target of cybercrime, identity theft, stalking, or even violence? I used to think this was silly, and then weird things started happening to me. Someone defaced my car. It had Lawfare license plates on it. Somebody delivered weird antique postcards of Guantanamo Bay to my house. You know, weird stuff. The volume of personal data online has tripled between 2019 and 2023, and angry individuals fueled by political polarization can access it all for up to 98% of American citizens. And I was one of them. Lots of people were using my name, my home address, other information about me to try to intimidate me. And I want to say that has dramatically slowed down in recent months, and one of the reasons is Delete Me. As I have said before, there are products here that I read the ads because, you know, that's my job, and there are products here that I read the ads because I really use them and really like them, and Delete Me is one of the Lawfare advertisers that I am most enthusiastic about, and here's why. It finds and removes personal information I don't want online, and it makes sure it stays off. It's a subscription service that removes your personal information from all of the largest search databases on the web, and in the process, it helps prevent potential identity theft, doxing, and phishing scams. And here's the important point. It doesn't just do it once, because the information will get back into the systems. It does it, and then it does it again. So the first time I got one of these reports, and they send regular reports at Delete Me, you know, there were a whole bunch of systems that I'd come off of. But then each time I get one now, there's still one or two or three that I'm back on the system and Delete Me has once again deleted me. So sign up and provide Delete Me with exactly what information you want deleted and their experts will take it from there. And as I say, they send regular personalized privacy reports showing what info they have found, where they found it, and what they removed. It's always working for you. Constantly monitoring and removing the personal information you don't want on the internet. When you sign up, they immediately go to work scrubbing all your personal information from data broker platforms. Your personal profile is no longer theirs to sell. So take control of your data and keep your private life private by signing up for Delete Me now at a special discount for Lawfare listeners. Today, get 20% off your Delete Me plan when you go to joindeleteme.com/lawfare20 and use the promo code lawfare20 at checkout. The only way to get 20% off is to go to joindeleteme.com/lawfare20 and enter code lawfare20 at checkout. That's joindeleteme.com/lawfare20, code lawfare20.
And so have there been, right, aside from you writing the story in the Times, like what has been the sort of accountability cycle here, right? Has there been an audit, right? Did the audit go well? Like, do we have any sense of whether there are going to be repercussions? Like, is there any sort of backtracking accountability?
Well, before we wrote about it, this actually was surprising to me. The UN has a really good audit system. There's a board of auditors that looks over the books of this agency every year, and they write out a long list of recommendations. It's a really diligent process. But I guess nobody has to listen to them because starting in 2019, they start warning like, hey, you're doing this wrong. You're violating your own rules about how money should be used. You're not, you know, you shouldn't give all your money to one person. And nobody seems to have cared about it at all. And certainly nobody. So the UN agency, those executives didn't seem to do anything about it. They have a board of diplomats from other countries who didn't seem to take any action about it. It was only at the end of last year, something happened, we don't still know what, that caused them to put Mr. Van Schelbloem, the number two person at this agency, on administrative leave. Quietly, they didn't tell anybody about it at the time. And then a guy at the UN, a blogger, a former UN official who's a blogger who's widely read there, starts writing about it in March. And then the agency starts talking more about it. Then they start sort of producing a little more accountability. But it was only after we wrote the story that the head of the agency, Greta Fermo, was asked to resign. And even then, so the UN has done an investigation of this, but they won't even show, which is over. They finished the investigation, but they won't even show it to like the American mission to the UN. I mean, it's not like it's not just me that doesn't have it or the public that doesn't have it. Even America, you know, one of the UN's biggest funders, can't get a copy of it. So it doesn't seem like even now there's a huge effort to provide some transparency about what went wrong.
So I want to take a bit of a step back and like think about, right, aside from this is really interesting, you know, there's all sorts of swanky parties and interesting people here. Like, there are also a bunch of like structural problems, right, that this hints at. And I think structural problems largely within the UN. So the first of which is you mentioned this a bunch of different times. There's this sort of like prestige hierarchy within the UN. Like that might be something that seems a little strange to people who know less. And even to me, like not something I give a lot of thought to. Talk a bit about like, what is that? And how does that sort of, as best you can tell, like inflect the way that business gets done at the UN?
So from what we've been told, there's a real sort of sense of personality. I mean, these are not personalities that you or I would know. You know, the people who are the undersecretary generals and the assistant secretary generals who head the various UN agencies, these are people that you've never heard of. But in their world, they're like gods. They are incredibly powerful. There's no mechanism of accountability for them outside of, you know, the secretary general, Antonio Guterres, could fire them. But there's very little accountability for them. And within their agency, you know, there's a real disconnect between the people at the top and then everybody else who does their bidding. And so the people at the top, what we had heard was there was this culture of impunity where they could say whatever they want, they could give whatever orders and people would follow. And their incentives, the people at the top, is not to spend money wisely, not to sort of be most efficient. It's to gain prestige in this world of the diplomats where they live. It's funny. My wife worked at the World Bank for a while, and it was very similar. You know, there are these people who are sort of like mid-level managers that even somebody who like me, who've been in Washington for a long time, covered politics, I'd never heard of these people. But in their world, they were like gods jockeying for power, and their images mattered a lot. And a lot of money was spent to burnish their image. And so in this case, at this UN agency, you see sort of an extreme example where when these people wanted to spend this much money, there was no one underneath them who felt like they could challenge them. And the above them, people are sort of too distracted or like not motivated to be a watchdog over this money. So in that world, this ground they occupy gives them a huge amount of latitude to do whatever they want without being challenged.
And you mentioned too that there's this weird implicit hierarchy between the sort of very public facing, you know, speech giving figureheads versus the sort of more internal, you know, maybe traditionally bureaucratic, like moving money around, like thinking seriously about what to do with grants. Like, what do you mean by that? Like, what's the sort of upshot of that weird duality?
Well, it to me, it doesn't seem like it's sort of something that has concrete elements, or that, you know, there's like a, you know, it's not like these people have a yearly evaluation with the Secretary General where he sits down and says, like, you know, you've been meeting expectations or not meeting expectations. The prestige comes from being on stage, being at a podium, being the one that everyone's paying attention to, both because those are the people who have the money and can make things happen, who can claim successes, but also because that is like a, you know, it's that in that world, visibility is really important. And so that's why this agency, as important as it was and as big as it was, I mean, it was one of the biggest UN agencies and certainly one of the most, it caused the most things in the world to change outside of UN headquarters. They saw themselves as, quote, the silent partner because they weren't up there on stage. And you see the sort of desire to be on stage so much that Greta Faramo, the head of this agency, as part of the contract, she gives $3 million to this charity started by a 23-year-old to write a pop song about the oceans. Part of the deal is that she, the head of the UN agency, wants to sing the song. She wants to go in front of the entire UN General Assembly during conference on the oceans. She flies a backing band in from the UK. She wants to sing the song. So, like, that's the desire to be in front, noticed, paid attention to. There's no glory that comes in doing the work behind the scenes.
And how does that relate to, you know, part of your story is this sort of weird, sceney world of parties and of people like, you know, this man who's somehow the ambassador from Dominica to a country that he has no discernible connection to. Like, how do those two things relate to one another? This sort of obviously sketchy thing that's happening and this, you know, weird hierarchical visibility game that's being played.
Well, I think that because of that, the sort of reward structure we're talking about is so intangible. It's more social and sort of PR related than anything that's like written down. The world of these parties actually, like, it makes a big difference. And so, you know, there are two different people in this story that were sort of like professional party hosts or important party hosts for the UN. One is a woman named Gloria Starr Kins. She's a journalist who's covered the UN since 1957. She's 95 now. She has this huge apartment on the Upper East Side. People go there for, you know, UN parties. I've never been to one of these parties. They don't look like a lot of fun. There's always a part in which a bureaucrat stands up and everyone has to listen to them talk about their latest initiative. And it seems like everybody is sort of pumping each other for money or information. But Paolo Zampoli, too. This is a guy who, like, his actual function at the UN is fairly small. Like, even the island of Dominica is not very big. He's not even the main ambassador for the island of Dominica. So, like, on paper, he carries very little weight. But he hosts parties, he connects people. And these people at the UN Office of Project Services said, like, we were surprised to find that this guy, who seemed, like, so peripheral, he was getting big guests at his parties. He had a nice apartment. Like, he was somebody who convened people together. And so he had this status that was far greater than his actual title would show. Because he gave you, as an up-and-coming UN person, a chance to be at a party with the Secretary General or somebody else.
And is it your sense that, like, these people, you know, these conveners, like, are they doing actually important work for the UN, right? Like, do they have this role because the UN is, like, maybe more informal and, like, there's fewer formal channels for, like, or is it just, like, it's a scene just like any, you know, elite political scene and these people are the conveners?
That's a good question. I mean, the UN is, I mean, obviously designed to be a lot of talk, you know, and a little bit and less action. So, like, talking is an important thing of what they do. And then if you bring people together, I guess that helps. But, like, Paolo Zampoli, his dream and, like, the way that he sees himself changing the world is starting a group called We Are the Oceans, which he describes as, he says, WATO is the NATO of the ocean. That's his goal. Not that it will, like, arm the sea creatures, but it will be like a powerful alliance of governments. And that thing, he's talked about it a lot, but it's never gotten off the ground. You know, so the thing that he wants, the way that he imagines projecting power, hasn't actually happened. But he still, you know, has this sort of informal role. And I do think that, you know, maybe for somewhat for good, but also in a way that wastes a lot of time, the UN is about these sort of social interactions rather than, you know, the actual business of the UN.
I mean, I wonder, like, you know, reading the story and sort of doing some prep for this podcast, I kept thinking about your old beat, right? Your old beat was sort of the Trump financial, I'll let you characterize it however you think it's best, but sort of the Trump financial underworld, right? Like, how does this feel similar, different to that? Like, how does reporting on this feel similar, different to that world? Right? Because in a lot of ways, there's some things that feel pretty similar, but then in certain important other ways, there are some differences.
Well, in this case, Paolo Zampoli is like an important character in the world of Trump. I mean, he was sort of, you know, he was a part of the Trump business. He introduced Donald and Melania. So there actually was this like one guy who overlapped from the two of them. The thing that I found similar was that there was, you know, the money was given to people ostensibly for a business purpose, but really there was no way you could look at this and say that it was the rational or correct business choice. And I felt like that was the same dynamic we confronted a lot covering Trump's business while he was president, which was like, you know, nominally he's getting business transactions from, you know, various people who want, you know, people who are in town to do business with, or a good example, when Trump was president, T-Mobile needed an approval for a big merger it was doing with Sprint. And as soon as they announced the merger, a whole bunch of T-Mobile executives came to the Trump Hotel, stayed at the Trump Hotel, like literally loitered around the Trump Hotel lobby in D.C. wearing their all magenta T-Mobile tracksuits. And that was the same thing. And that, like, yes, nominally there was a business purpose, that nominally there was a rationale, but there's obviously an effort to like ingratiate yourself with people who have real power. And I felt like that was the same dynamic we were confronting here, that, like, you know, the people at the UN say, look at, you know, we thought it made sense to give this guy the money, but it really didn't. And so you're trying to figure out, well, what's the real explanation for it?
And did the reporting process feel similar to the sort of like Trump reporting process?
I mean, it's similar in that you're dealing with a highly secretive organization that where people, you know, you have to call 100 people to get one person to talk. That was definitely true. I mean, some of these people did, Paolo Zampoli talked to us a lot, but getting people inside that UN agency, because there's such a, like, either you're a UN lifer and you don't want to speak up, or, you know, people move out of the, even people who've left this agency have left it to go to a field that was adjacent to it and don't want to burn any bridges. So it was hard to find people who knew enough about this organization's actions to talk about it, you know, in detail, but were far enough away that they were willing to talk about it in detail with their names attached. And that felt a lot like covering the Trump organization. It's like, you know, you cover the Trump, you know, you worked at the Trump organization, you hated your experience there, but now you work at a rival hotel, or you work at a golf course assessment company or whatever. So, you know, you're less, even though you don't like Trump, you don't want to burn your bridges in the industry, because it's, you know, these are often small industries and the UN adjacent world is actually quite small. So that felt very similar.
And I wonder, like, is your reaction after having reported this story and, you know, gotten some sense of what this UN world is like, is the reaction that, like, okay, you know, this is political corruption of one stripe or another, like, exists within the high echelons of all sorts of different, you know, elite political worlds, whether it be the UN or, you know, the Trump administration or any US presidential administration? Or is it you're like, you know, you report this story and it's like, whoa, there are some particularly bad things happening at the UN, or there's some particular pathologies on display here?
To me, it felt, you know, so I've written a lot about waste in the US government, you know, and like trying to find out, when you find a really wasteful example of US government spending, to try to figure out where it came from and who was supposed to be watching it. So the UN was on a different scale, both because they have a lot more money and because there's even less accountability. I mean, people say Congress isn't accountable. People say, you know, these U.S. government agencies that waste a lot of money aren't accountable, but they are. I mean, there's people who ultimately could cut off their funding. There's voters who could throw them out of office. So it was like that dynamic, the wastefulness of a big government bureaucracy on steroids, because this was like, what, even these people were even further away from the people whose money it was, and who might actually impose like some kind of accountability over them. And it did make me think that there's probably a lot more of this at the UN, because it is so removed from anybody who would be like, hey, that's my money, what are you doing with it?
And it also feels pretty removed from like formal rules, right? Like, you have this guy who is at once the ambassador from a country to the UN, but he's also, right, like,
he's not from that country. Yeah.
He's not from that country. He's very publicly pursuing like business opportunities by dint of his role at the UN, right? That seems, that also feels like different.
Yes, totally. I mean, by the way, his wife is a Brazilian model who is the UN ambassador from a country where she's not from, the island of Grenada. Yeah, it's a place where, yeah, it's sort of like a Congress in that, like, you know, everybody in Congress has gotten somebody sign off to be there. They're representing somebody, and you could point to who they're representing, but not really, because Paolo, like, he has a diplomatic, you know, permission from someplace, but he's really representing himself. It's not like he's accountable in the same way to the country of Dominica that a member of Congress is accountable to his, you know, his voters. So yes, there's ways into this world where you can kind of buy or wheedle that access, which makes it even more confusing and even less accountable.
And so to the extent that you feel like there are any sort of big takeaways from this, I think probably the best place to end is sort of thinking those through. Like, what do you feel like, looking back on this, like what strikes you as like the biggest, you know, structural takeaway, accountability focused takeaway, maybe bookkeeping takeaway, anything like that?
Well, I'll give you like a UN account, UN takeaway, and then a takeaway from me as a reporter. The takeaway from the UN is just that there's so much money there and so much good intentions, but there's so little policing at the UN. There's so little oversight. That's what surprised me, is it was not like these people were hiding what they were doing, that they were hiding, they'd given all their money to this guy. You know, they were public about it and they were putting out audit reports every year, but somebody has to care enough to call you on it. And nobody did. In fact, when we talked to people who were the overseers, the diplomats who were supposed to be watchdogging the money, even they were sort of like, well, I don't know, is it that bad? You know, they one of the lines in the story was they, even after it all went bad, after everybody knew they'd lost at least $22 million, or they were expecting to lose $22 million, the UN overseers were like, well, give us a full report on this in June 2024. You know, so if that's the way that's what happens, even when you screw up on a massive scale, like what's happening when people are just being wasteful at a smaller scale. And I felt like the UN is sort of ripe for that kind of accountability. So I'm hoping we can do more stories like this. Just as an aside, the journalistic takeaway from this is that it was an example of, you should never leave any person uncalled, even anybody. So the way we cracked the party part of this was that, so Daisy Kendrick, we knew about her charity. We got a copy from the New York Secretary of State of its incorporation papers, and it listed Daisy Kendrick and these two names we'd never heard of, Gloria Kins and Rami Azzouri. And looking at that, you probably thought, well, these are like Daisy's friends, or they're accomplices in this in some way. But we called them anyway, and it turned out that they had, as I said, they had no idea what was going on. They had no idea that they were involved with this, or that they barely even knew Daisy. But the great thing was that they knew other stuff that we had no way of finding out otherwise. They were like, well, did you know about this party? Did you know I was at the party? Here's what happened. You know, so the lesson of like, don't ever assume you know what somebody's going to know, or that somebody's not going to be able to be useful. You got to call everybody. Because those two people who were not at all what they were supposed to be on the form still were so valuable for us. I mean, just as an example, we were trying to figure out at this party. So supposedly David Kendrick meets the UN people at this party in 2015. And I was trying to figure out like, oh, how am I ever going to confirm that? Right. How will I prove these people met at this specific party? And even if I can prove they met, how can I prove they're meeting for the first time? And so we got Gloria Starr Kins, the person who hosted the party, was so mad that her name had been listed as a director of this charity that, you know, she'd never heard of, that she was like, well, here, you know, look at these party pics that I took at this party. And you can see in the sequence of there's actually a photo of Greta Ferramo, the head of the UN agency, holding a business card for the David Kendrick's company. And she's turned it, you know, not on purpose, but she's holding it so that you can see the logo on the business card. And if we didn't have that, I wouldn't have been confident enough to know that was the party they met at. But so like that was an example of, you know, call everybody, even if you think they may not be helpful. You don't really know until you call them.
And that is a good story to end on. David, thank you so much.
Thank you.
The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. You can get ad-free versions of this and other Lawfare podcasts by becoming a material supporter at patreon.com/lawfare. You'll also get access to special events and other content available only to our subscribers. Today, May 13th, Benjamin Wittes will be sitting down with two experts to discuss the latest intelligence community transparency report. What does it tell us, and what do we still not know? Please rate and review the Lawfare Podcast wherever you get your podcasts, and look out for our other podcasts, including Rational Security, Chatter, The Aftermath, and coming soon,
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Allies, a podcast about the special immigrant visa program and the withdrawal from Afghanistan. And while you're at it, check out our written work at lawfareblog.com. The podcast is edited by Jen Padjehal, and your audio engineer this week was Isabel Kirby McGowan. Our music is performed by Sophia Yan, and as always, thank you for listening.